And today is February 25th, and we're getting started as some of the members join us, but it is the time of year where people are testifying in other committees, so I expect people will be coming in and out as we go. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to jump the gun on you, Mr. Bender. Did you have anything you wanted to share for us, share with us before I started the informational meeting?
No, I just have something relevant to the informational meeting, though, that might be of interest before you get started. Just to remind the subcommittee members that the state lottery is not a budget that the legislature approves. So you'll see that this is an informational meeting. It's not there's not a bill scheduled. There is not a budget bill for the state lottery commission. But typically, each session, we ask the lottery to come to this subcommittee to talk about and to update you on lottery operations. And much of the lottery funds are distributed by this subcommittee, particularly in the economic development area. So Director Roberts is prepared to do that. We think Eric, is it still possible to set up the
yes.
projector?
Yes.
So he'll be able to project this on the screen. But he is also, if you look in OLIS at today's meeting, you'll see that his presentation that he'll be going through has been uploaded there. It's the OSL State Lottery overview presentation.
And it looks like we have the projectors working, but the screens are not down yet. I'm sure they will be in a moment. And I know Senator Johnson is conflicted right now, so she asked me to go ahead and start the meeting. She will be joining us shortly. Mr. Roberts, if you'd like to come up and join us. Welcome, Mr. Director.
Thank you. It's great to be here. See if we can work the technology out.
All right, thank you.
For the record, I'm Jack Roberts, the executive director of the Oregon Lottery, and I've asked our chief financial officer, Kathy Ortega, to come up here in case the question gets really tough. I'll be able to turn to someone. and I'll try to see if I can work out this. No, that didn't work. So I have to be. Oh, this is easier? Okay. All right, great, thanks. I wanted to start with reviewing the Oregon Lottery timeline, particularly in relationship to where the state has been as some of these developments have occurred. 1984, we passed the Oregon Lottery. It was a citizens' initiative, but for those of us who were around then, remember that this is after lotteries were first becoming popular in the country, and the people who sold the machines and the different materials that were used with lotteries were going around from state to state trying to get the folks to adopt the lottery. And in each state, they usually would do some polling to find out what people cared about, and particularly where they wanted the money to go. Most states wanted to have it go to education. But Oregon, for those of you who were here in 1984, and remember 1984, we were very slow in crawling out of that terrible recession that we had. And so when they asked Oregonians, they said, we want jobs and economic development. And so the Oregon Lottery was initially, the funds were exclusively dedicated to economic development, and it was passed by the voters with a 66% vote. And from that, we helped really join with other states in setting up a lot of what today we take for granted, the lottery, including the early draw games like Powerball, which was the first multi-state game. And legend is that it was an Oregonian who came up with the name Powerball. Unfortunately, whoever he or she was didn't copyright that, but it's something we've been with really from the beginning. Then, of course, in 1990, Oregon voters had a property tax revolt and passed ballot measure 5, which sort of reversed our funding of schools from 2/3 being local property tax and about 1/3 the state to the reverse, where the state was expected to pick up 2/3 of that. But there were no additional revenues provided at the time. And so while the economy was pretty good then, it put a tremendous strain on other general fund funded areas. And that was then, in 1991, we decided to add two of the traditional games which we had helped develop, video poker. We were following the lead of South Dakota, which had adopted that 2 years earlier. And we saw that as a way to help provide some additional needed revenue for the needs of the state. At that time, still dedicated exclusively to economic development, but we were getting pretty creative at deciding what was economic development. And I remember we decided that we were on the prison building binge at the same time we decided that building a prison was economic development. So those days were ones that strained the creativity of the state government. Then in 1993, we decided maybe a better way to help pay for schools was the sales tax. And as part of a long tradition that preceded, but has also extended since then, it failed with just 25% of the vote. And that then led to us in 1995. The then new governor, John Kitzhaber, and Republican legislature had talked about what they could do, and the decision was to refer out to the voters an amendment to the constitutional provisions on the lottery to allow education as well as economic development to be used. And at this time, we were already seeing signs that the video lottery was becoming a major moneymaker for the state. And it remains to this day the only major replacement revenue that we have passed for school funding since Measure 5 and the other property tax limitation measures that we have. Anyway, remember that fall, and it's not listed here, but it followed with other property tax limitation measures, 47 and 50, which again put a great strain on the general fund. And so things other than education and public safety and public health were getting very strained. And so Citizens in 1998 put on the ballot a measure that would devote 15% of lottery revenues, divided half to parks and beaches and half to watershed and habitat restoration as part of the Salmon Recovery Plan. And that also passed with 67% of the vote and continues to this day. And so increasingly, the Oregon Lottery was being used to fund things that were voted on by the people through the constitutional process. Economic development, education, and the parks and beaches and watersheds. And those remain the principal things that we fund today, and they're all constitutional. In 2005, and this again followed another serious recession that curtailed general fund money for schools and public health, and we were kicking families off the Oregon Health Plan, we were shortening school years and increasing class sizes, and so the Oregon Lottery Commission authorized the addition of line games to video poker as a way to boost the revenue. And the legislature passed a bill. We had limited the number of video lottery machines per retailer to 5, and that was increased to 6. And at the same time, increased the revenue, there was a move then to reduce the commissions. And I'm not going to go over the whole history. I'll show you something a little bit later that shows how the commission schedules have changed. But it ended up being a major revenue source boost for the state. Then in January 1, 2009, we had a vote for a statewide ban on indoor smoking, which I personally would say has been a great boon to the quality of life of Oregonians, and it's something that's very popular. But it did have an adverse impact on revenue for our video lottery machines, as it had in other states when they did that. And at the same time, we had a terrible recession. So the revenue began to decline for the first time since really the inception of the lottery. And in 2010, Oregon voters removed the sunset on the parks and those spaces to make that permanent, which originally had a sunset. And that passed with 54% of the vote. So even in the tight money times, people reconfirmed their desire to have the lottery used to fund those. So that timeline and their, in terms of looking at how that's shaped and changed the way we fund ourselves generally, but the role that the lottery has played in helping to fill some of the gaps we had for those important needs. Now, I'm forgetting my...
Mr. Director, how much did lottery revenue decline with the passage of the...
We have a chart coming up in just a minute. I'll show you that.
Thanks.
So the mission, the lottery's mission, which has remained unchanged really from the beginning, is to operate a lottery with the highest standards of integrity and security to earn maximum profits for the people of Oregon, commensurate with the public good. And those are very strong values that we have. Obviously, some of them are subject to debate of what is commensurate with the public good, how much should we be doing, how much gambling is commensurate with the public good. Some would say no gambling is commensurate with the public good. Others would say maximizing the revenue is commensurate with the public good. But it gives us some sense of how we balance that, and particularly the part about security and integrity are things that we take very seriously. Now, this is where the money goes. And most of that, the general categories are defined by the Constitution, but you have a lot of discretion over how that is spent. And in this chart, you can see the largest portion is the legislative allocation. That's primarily what is paid for education, for current education funding, and economic development. And of that, the education piece is the largest. The parks and the natural resources, that 15% is constitutionally dedicated. You have no discretion over the amount of money, but within those categories, you do have a lot to say about how that gets spent. The Education Stability Fund is a sort of like a rainy day fund for schools. That's been constitutionally dedicated and set up from the early inception when the early decision in 1995 to make that that dedication included a part of it. It's not just for current funding, but for rainy day fund. Statutorily, you have set aside a minimum of 1% for problem gambling services. That pays for treatment. We have probably the best public-funded system of treating gambling in the country, and that money is through the Oregon Health Authority. We work a lot with them in terms of getting the word out on the help lines and information that we have. That amount is statutory, and so there is, when times are really tough, from time to time the legislature has adjusted that, but by and large it's been a consistent source of revenue and it has been very effective. Then finally, the bond debt service, which we, in the Constitution, it provides for that. It provides that money on the bonds will be paid first. So if we at some time get into a crunch, that money has to be paid. Our policy, the state's policy, is to maintain a 4-to-1 debt service coverage. We have the highest rated lottery-backed bonds in the country and have a great record, but it's also an important part of funding the use of those has to be within the categories that are permissible for lottery uses. So a lot of it is for economic development. There's a lot of it that's for education, and we also use it for the parks and open space. And even transportation gets some under the rubric of economic development, and so it's an important part of how we fund. Now this is where the revenues come in, and you'll see we split this up into two categories. One is the traditional lottery and the revenue that it brings, and that's the light green. And then the blue is for video lottery. And we trace it back to the beginning of the period of time in which we started doing the video lottery. And there were actually 95 was after we'd had a first run of it, and when we started addressing some of those issues about how we are going to grow that. And as you'll see, it started about the same as traditional in terms of total revenue, but it quickly outpaced that. The tradition has been fairly flat over the years. It'll be up a little bit, down a little bit. It's a constant challenge. Keep coming up with new games and new things to attract people, but it remains fairly stable. But there, when you see the very large increase of the period there, that was when we added line games and when we added Six Machine, and we saw a significant increase in revenue. And that continued till 2009. That's where I mentioned before the indoor smoking ban. And it's hard to tell how much of an impact that really had. In some respects, it had a positive impact, I think, on players, in that those who are smokers find themselves needing to break from play and go outside and smoke a cigarette, which may not be good for their health. But the break in play, we believe, is helpful in people who might be otherwise addicted to have some reason to break. What we're trying to do is work, and I'll talk about this a little bit later, to do other things to create breaks in play for people, short of risking cancer by smoking. So it's we like to have more of a win-win if we can with that. But that's also the time we saw the effects of the recession. And there you saw a significant decline in our revenue. Since that time, it has grown up slowly. It's not growing at the same pace that it did back in the 90s. We are seeing some increase. If you look just at our video lottery sales, they've been growing by about 1% a year the last 4 years. This year, with the new machines we're putting in, we're seeing a greater level of increase, and so we're hoping that we can continue that and build on it. But we're also struggling to some extent with our traditional play. And so as a revenue source, today the lottery looks like it's fairly flat. Our goal is to try to at least have it growing with the economy and with the things we're seeing happening. So that's a great part of our challenge. Now, the revenue is one thing, but the amount of money that we have to transfer to the state is another. And there we have to take out a lot of the expenses, particularly with the traditional games. The lottery money is more of a net because people win, people lose, and at the end we count as our revenue what's left after you net out the losers from the winners. For the traditional, we have the prizes are paid separately, and so when we look at the sales amount, which end up being about 30% from traditional and 70% from the lottery, but when we look at our transfers, and you'll see the red on top here is how much is the traditional. Obviously, most of that money comes to the blue. It's 85 to 90% of the transfers to the legislature come from video lottery, and only about 10 to 15% come from the traditional. We keep trying to grow that. We're still working on it. The interesting thing is that 50% of Oregonians play some form of lottery within a year. And of that, a much smaller fraction play the video lottery games. The traditional, more people play, but they don't play very much, and the net amount that we receive from it. But it is very much a part of our brand. It's a reason why consistently, year after year, when we survey how people feel about the lottery, 65% of Oregonians have a favorable impression of the Oregon Lottery. And that, interestingly enough, conforms with the percentage that voted for the lottery in the first place and that have supported things over the years that we've put before them. And so we think that that's a critical part of the public acceptance of the lottery are our traditional games. But particularly as the Ways and Means Committee, I think it's important that you understand that we are heavily reliant on the video lottery as the major source of the revenue that we have spent. And so, you know, people can draw from that whatever conclusions they want, but I do think it's important to point out that's where the money comes from. And the commissions are also an issue a lot of people talk about, and there are a lot of strong feelings that people have about the commission rates. When we started, we paid 35% flat rate across the board. That's the same thing that South Dakota started with. We've each brought that down significantly. Illinois is just now starting to get into the video lottery business, and they're sort of modeling it after us. They allow 5 machines in their establishments, and they're starting at 35%. And I can guarantee you they will not stay there. There's not really enough left for the state after that, and they have a different model, too, that we actually own and are responsible for the machines. We contract with retailers to allow us to put our machines in their establishment. And people sometimes say, oh, why are we doing that? Isn't that prohibitively expensive? Other states, what they do is they have retailers, but they also have people called operators who then own and do the other part of that work and make a substantial return on that. In fact, South Dakota is a good example where their commission rate is a flat 22.5%. They also allow people to have 15 machines in their establishments. The operators also get 22.5%. And there's another 5% that's carved out so that the state ends up getting 50% on their video lottery machines. We, by operating, being the operating part of it, we turn over 65% to you as our the state's share of that, because we replace the operator and we run it ourselves, and we think that's a good model. And it's interesting. I mentioned about Illinois. Illinois gives 35% to the retailers, and then another 30 or 35% to the operators, and they get roughly a third. That's why I say eventually they're going to have to change that, because that's not a good model. But this shows you that we have brought that down substantially. We did decide back during that time when we were dropping it that out of respect for the small retailers who were struggling, we would end up keeping a high rate for small retailers that then drops down to as low as 11%, and then have a flatter but still declining rate for the larger retailers. And at the beginning of the year, they have to guess which one they're going to be and make a decision, and sometimes they guess wrong and have to eat some of it. But that's one of the things, the challenge that we have dealing with, is the complexity of the system we have set up. But overall, we're still roughly in line with what others make with the size of the retailer base we have. We think that it's a reasonably fair approach, but it's one of the things that's often contentious, and that we end up having public debates about by all sorts of people, and we try to do the best we can going forward to maintain that strong base of people who really are our distribution system. And speaking of the retailers, this shows the number of retailers we've had going back to 2005. And during the time when we had the great growth in our revenues, and we had a system that was really more attractive to a lot of people, we had a tremendous growth in it. And that peaked in 2010. With the recession, the other things that happened, we've had a somewhat slow decline in the number of retailers. And that's one of the things we're trying to turn around. As it is, you have to be an OLCC licensee to have lottery. But only one out of three licensees choose to have lottery. And we're trying to figure out why that is. Part of what we think it is that we have been ourselves responsible for requiring signage and promotional things that, in my opinion, cheapen the establishments where we have it. And we're now trying to change that and try to have things that are more consistent with the ambiance of the establishment itself, so that places that are successful restaurants can have a part set aside where can age control it and make sure you don't have line of sight for children, but still have in your establishment more opportunities for people to, while they're waiting for their table or whatever they want to do. We want to broaden that so that the lottery is not simply associated with establishments where that's a major component of what they do. But that's something we're trying to do now, and we realize that we have to change our approach and part of our brand to do that.
Senator Hassel.
Mr. Roberts, what would, I'm assuming that each of these has at least five machines. Would that be a safe assumption?
No, most have at least five, but there are some smaller that will have two or three.
What has been the primary reason for someone who had the machines and then moves forward without them?
Most of them are not current owners who say come and get this. Sometimes it'll be on a sale, and the new owners will decide they don't want to do that, or they want to remodel, they want to do something different. And sometimes it's people who go out of business, and it may not even be a restaurant anymore. So part of that doesn't necessarily reflect that people have just turned against the lottery. It can be because of some of the economic circumstances that were going on. We have very few people who are existing retailers. But in the past, when we lost people, we would expect to replace that by new growth. And we're not doing that as much, but we'd like to do better.
Oh, do you, are there enforcement issues that cause people to forego the machines as well? They don't follow the rules or some type of?
We do. We do pull the contracts from people who run afoul of our rules and don't perform in accordance with our standards. And also, there are also some people who, because we do an extensive background check on people who want to do this, and there are some people who don't get a contract because they're not, they don't pass that.
Thank you.
Representative Comfort.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair.
Mr. Director, you've showed us the trends with revenue. You've showed us the trends with the number of retailers. I wanted to ask a similar question to the Senator. If you had a slide that was showing the number of machines, do you think the trends would be similar to what we've seen in the number of retailers, or do you think that perhaps the number of machines is increasing even when the number of retailers is declining?
No, in fact, actually, I almost included that. The problem is the numbers are so disparate, I would have had to a different chart, but what's interesting is that the and I can get you this information. We do have some we have some charts we prepared. The number of retailers of the number of machines has also declined, but not as much as the retailers. So what ends up happening is that there are although initially it did back at when the company first turned down, they were both going down substantially. But it it doesn't make up for that in terms of the number of machines or the number of retailers, it's we're still down. Now, I'm not saying whether that's necessarily a good or bad thing. It depends on why that's happening, but it's something that we're concerned about. If it really means that there are areas that, I mean, if you can use the term underserved with the lottery machines, I realize that some people would quibble with that, but it's not a situation where we're making up in the intensity of the machines what we're losing in terms of number of retailers.
Follow-up. Thank you for that explanation. So I'm inferring from what you said that if the number of retailers is declining faster than the number of machines, that means the number of machines per establishment is trending up.
It is slightly. It's not a huge difference, but it's the ones who are surviving are typically those who do have more machines and are doing higher volume, and so we did. As I said, I can get you. We've done some looking at that, and what we've seen is that has countered a little bit of the impact of the decline, but we've still not really seen. And we hope we're now seeing that today as we're starting to enjoy some increase, but we haven't fully recovered from what we had during the recession.
All right, thank you very much.
Senator Hanson.
Follow-up question too on the decline. Are you able to track, or have you, the impact that maybe the rise of Indian gaming has had on the Oregon lottery activity?
We don't have any real specific studies on that. We've looked kind of anecdotally and followed it, and we don't think that's really been a big impact. The tribal casinos, for the most part, not exclusively, but most of them have been in more remote areas, and we don't see them as a direct competition. And they haven't really, in the time we've seen that decline, it's much more closely correlated to the economy as a whole. And as I mentioned, the indoor smoking ban, which, yes, some of our retailers will complain that in the tribal casinos you can still smoke. But I think the effect of that has pretty well been adjusted, and I also know we're not going back. But on the economy, I think it's a lot of what's happened to us is the same thing that's happened to other consumer items and items or things that are people don't have to have. They've been really slow to return to their spending, but we're now seeing some greater confidence in where the economy is and where it's going, and we're also and I'll talk in a minute about the video lottery terminal replacements, because we held on to these machines, which normally The people who sell them to you will say it has like a 3 to 5 year life. Realistically, in the real economy, it's about a 5 to 7 year life. We're now replacing 10, 11 year old machines because we didn't want to do that during the time, and we didn't frankly have the money to do that during the recession period. And so we're seeing some reinvigoration in it through that, and we're hoping that will continue.
Senator Monroe.
Yeah, Jack, I'm concerned, as we all are, on problem gambling, and there's a certain percentage of our players that become serious problem gamblers. Are they more likely to be playing the video or the line games?
And and I'll get to this in a minute. We're doing some more research on that. We're in fact getting ready to do a prevalence study, which shows how many people are playing, what they're doing. We did one 10 years ago, and we haven't done one since. But I think most of the evidence is there's a higher risk of addictive behavior and problem gambling with the video. And the other one that runs into a lot of it is Keno. It's usually the ones that are kind of fast moving. Frankly, if you're buying a Powerball ticket and waiting 2 days to find out whether you won or not, it's hard to get addicted. but if you can play and then immediately play and then immediately play, that's where the addiction comes in. And so we're trying to work hard in dealing with that. But again, and I'm you know, being as honest and direct as I can, the idea that, well, if the video lottery games, the problem is get rid of them, we have a huge hole to replace in our budget if we do that. So until the decision is made by the state of Oregon to get out of that business, our plan is to do what we can. And we're actually working with a process with the OLCC and with our retailers that we want to have training for problem gambling like they do for alcohol problems. And our goal ultimately is to have every server card include with it not only that you go through the testing about the for serving alcohol, but also be trained on the gambling addiction and problems with that. There's been a little bit of pushback that only about a third of the licensees have lottery or the video lottery in particular. But the truth is, people get their card, they may move from job to job, and we'd like to have them pre-trained on that, and also because places that don't have lottery today may have it tomorrow, and we think it's an important part. And once we can get that established, and there is some concern on the part of some retailers, well, we don't want to have our people intervening and do it. And we said that's not what we're trying to do. We're trying to get you to be aware of what's going on, and you can give them information about the helpline and the other things that we can have, so we can try to deal with that. And we're looking for other ways to try to help deal with that problem. We're very much aware of it. We're very committed. In fact, you may remember at this last session, we had a bill that, in effect, overturned the opinion that came out of the Attorney General's office saying that we couldn't spend our money on that. And we basically had the legislature authorize that directly as a part of our commitment to the public good, and also trying to help in terms of protecting a workforce that's not addicted to gambling or anything else. So we're very cognizant of that problem. We don't pretend that we have it licked by any means, but we're working very hard to be responsible.
Have you done any studies on the demographics of your average video player? Do they tend to be well-educated, poorly educated, rich, poor, live in certain areas or other areas? Have you done any demographic studies, of who does this? I've got some friends that are very wealthy and they're heavily addicted to this. I've got other friends that never touch it. So I just wondered if any studies have been done.
That's part of what we want to look at, our prevalence study. We do regular studies about who are lottery players, and we have done some carve out of looking at the video. What I would tell you, and from a business model standpoint, it's a concern that we have, that is that younger people don't seem to be playing. And so they do tend to be older people. Now, there are a lot of questions about that. Is that because you have so much opportunity to play games on your cell phone, if you have the Xbox and those things, that by the time they look at these are pretty dull. And so that's That's one. The other thing we're not sure about is that because when they're young, they don't have the disposable income, they don't have the interest, and as they get older, will they have an interest in it or not? And you know, well, that's going to take time to see how that goes. But it does not appear that, for the most part, the people who play are poor because, frankly, I mean, it's an expensive game. By the same token, as you're pointing out, people who are very well off and don't, quote unquote, need the money like to play. So we're going to try to do, and we've put up some money, but we're not doing the study. The Oregon Council on Problem Gambling is doing it, and we got the tribes to contribute some money, and some other folks, the council itself. So we're paying the lion's share of it, but we're glad to do that, but have it done by a neutral professional party to give us some data, and then we want to follow up, not wait 10 years to do it again, but try to see how the demographics are changing and some of that information you're talking about.
Representative Woodson.
Yes. I don't use ATM machines, and I was wondering, are there ATM machines in the same room as the video lottery games?
That's a really good question, and the answer right now is that yes, what we're trying to do is encouraging people, because a lot of these places have them anyway because people need cash, but the idea of not having it right by the machines, having it somewhere else and moving with it, that's one that we've had some pushbacks for, because a lot of folks don't have adequate space for them away from the machines, but that is one of the concerns that problem gambling experts say. That ready access to cash, people who start playing with the best of intentions to set a limit. That's what we encourage people to do, set a limit on time, set a limit on money. And in that sense, it's not that different from people who are drinking. You can start with the best of intentions, but when you get past a certain point, you find yourself exceeding your limits. And so that is one of the, it's balancing that with the business needs of the establishment generally, but that's something that we want to try to have a more positive impact on.
Follow up. Do ATMs provide cash back on any of the EBT cards for that we provide low-income people in Oregon? There are certain things you can convert to cash, like TANF, and they're all contained on the same card. And I was wondering if do you know if ATMs accept EBT cards?
I don't know I'm not sure whether there are different kinds and different ones. I think most of them I don't believe do, but I don't know whether that's exclusive.
Okay, and a further follow-up. I was wondering if you have tracked in the facilities that use or have lottery EBT conversion of cash in those facilities, and I recognize sometimes they're in restaurants and bars and this sort of thing, but do we actually know how many EBT cards are cashed out or part of it in these facilities that have the lottery?
We don't have that information, and you're right, in some cases it would be difficult to trace how they use the money once they get the cash. But that's a good suggestion. It's one of the things, because we are very much aware of that as a risk for people who, as I say, with the best of intentions, suddenly feel like they're due to win, and all these other myths that people believe about how the machines work, and they think I'll take a little bit of money out of my account and I'll pay it back with all my winnings. And that's a good suggestion. We need to look at that.
One more follow-up. There is a bill coming through the legislature this session which will put a name on these EBT cards, basically, and so we're going to be able to track them somewhat better if this bill goes through, which hopefully I think there's the desire for that to happen now. So maybe we could work on figuring out if some of these are actually, this money is supposed to be going to families who are in need and children and, you know, the whole thing. So I think one of the things we really need to clean up in lottery, if you will, is not making it easy for these folks to convert their social welfare services into gambling money. Just the statement. No, you don't need to answer it.
No, we would be real happy to work on that.
Thank you.
All right. no more questions. We're going to, Mr. Bender is going to pass out a chart.
I don't know.
I didn't know if you wanted to.
Let me see if there's anything else here that really needs to go. We've already talked about some of the responsible gambling and some of what we've done there. And problem gambling.
Mr. Roberts, please, I don't mean to rush you. I thought that Mr. Bender wanted to distribute this graph that he had now, and okay. I didn't.
Well,
you've still got more presentation.
I was going to show you how the structure is.
Please
for the,
do.
For the commission. We have a 5-member commission appointed by the governor, serves the pleasure of the governor, and then the director sort of follows their direction, but is in a sense independent. And the governor appoints the director, removable at the pleasure of the director. And then we have assistant directors. Under the Constitution, we can't have more than 4 assistant directors. We actually have 3 if you count the deputy director as one. But then we have people under the deputy director who might otherwise seem like that. So it's an organizational structure that has been around for a long time. And it's basically the security. And that is required under the statute. It's jointly operated with the Oregon State Police, and it serves as part of not only ensuring that we have retailers, but also all of our employees. You can't work the lottery if you've been convicted of a felony or of any crime related to gambling. So all of this was built into the constitutional amendment initially because of the public's concern about the integrity and safety of it. So we do that. And then sales and marketing is obviously a critical part of what we do, but we also have the IT part of it, which is we do a lot of the work on our machines, and we contract for the machines themselves, but we have a high level of technology. Finance, which Kathy Ortega heads up and makes sure that we are on the up and up, and she does a great job of making sure everything's accounted for. And then human resources, which is also important part. We have over 400 employees and manage that.
Mr. Roberts, before you go ahead, your commission, are they at full strength now, and are any of them serving over their allotted time?
No. We have all 5, and in fact, I think there are 2 of them whose terms will be up later this year, and one, I think, in 2016. But I think all of them are serving in their first term and so would be eligible to be reappointed depending on what the governor does.
And could you give just a snapshot profile of what geographic areas they represent, what the composition of the commission is?
Yes, we are required, in fact, that's part of what I was going to talk about here. We're required to have one person from law enforcement and have one person as accountant. And we have a Portland detective, Mary Wheat, and serves in the law enforcement role. We actually have 2 accountants, Raul Valdivia, who's from Salem, and he used to be an auditor in the Secretary of State's office, and now he's a CPA in private practice. And the other one is a former legislator, Chris Telfer, who is from Bend, and she I think was maybe 2 or 3 years ago. Her term is up.
Hmm? Is that Chris Telfer?
Yeah, Chris Telfer. And the most recent appointee is Liz Carl, who's an attorney, used to be in the DA's office and now does is in private practice. She's in Corvallis. And then the chair is Lisa DeZono, who is an attorney from Portland.
Thank you very much. Okay, please continue.
So the responsible gambling, we try to distinguish between responsible gambling, which is try to help people stay out of problems, and there's a lot that's been done in that area. We just recently adopted by our commission a responsible gambling code of practice. This is Representative Gumbert may remember that was part of a bill that the House passed but did not make it through the Senate, but and Representative Tomei was sponsored that. And I told her when the bill died that we plan to do that anyway. And we have followed through with that, and we've done that. We're working on some other things that were also talked about in that bill. And as we get the new machines, trying to have some things that are built into that that will help with that. So we're working hard to try to encourage people to be responsible players. And we do have ads. About 10% of the advertising we do is geared toward the responsible gambling. Now, I realize that leaves 90% trying to sell our product, because that is what we do. But we're very careful in how we do that. We generally, on regular television, we only do the traditional product. We don't do lottery. We do the lottery, the video lottery occasionally, and we've done some recently as we're putting the new machines in online, but we try to pick sites that are age appropriate and use that as a way to target our audience. We're very careful trying not to advertise gambling to people who aren't supposed to be gambling. And then the problem gambling is the part where people have already gotten in trouble and we need help. And we have worked very effectively. We have a number of ads on that. We've actually won awards with some of our ads. One was what we call the powder room ad. It's people talking in the, women talking in the restroom about some sort of gossiping about some friend of theirs who had a gambling problem. And one of them speaks up and said, well, I've been there myself and I've seen what it's like, and it kind of brings a room to quiet. Then as they're leaving, then one of the other women comes back in and says, can we talk? Our most recent one that we have is the bowling alley, where people are waiting for a friend to show up, and that friend is gambling and checks and wants to borrow money, and they're saying, oh, this is terrible, what can we do? And says, why doesn't he just quit? And so one of the women there says, it's sometimes you need help. He said, I know I did. And they all look at her kind of surprised. So part of what we're trying to do is to point out, you can't spot who the problem gamblers are. There's no identifying characteristics of who they are. Everybody is potentially at risk of that, depending on what's going on in their life, what their other factors they have and things, and trying to make sure that they get help, and get help hopefully before they've ruined their finances, broken up their family, or lost their job. Now, the video lottery terminal replacement plan, this is something that we've been working on for several years. It's our outmoded machines, but it also will give us the chance to hook up with a network that is now operating more on a traditional Ethernet, Internet type of a network. Currently, we have an outmoded system that is literally becoming unavailable in the near future. It hooks up people to a fixed cable, and it does not allow for communication with us or with each other in a way that we have to send people physically out to install new games. And what we'll be able to do with the new machines, which not only play better, more active games, but also will allow us to change the games from our office. We can download them and send them through. It will also, once we're entirely into that, it will give us the ability to have what they call the player identification cards, where people who play, and this is going to be a question, some places have tried to make this mandatory, and they find people really push back on anyone keeping track of their information and their data, but try to find ways to provide incentives for people to voluntarily do that. They will allow them to track how much they're playing, what they're spending, what they're losing, and will help us with some of the problem gambling programs that we have in identifying people who need to. There is an ability to have a voluntary cutoff where you set a limit and then you won't be able to play anymore. And that's one that I know in some states, I think Massachusetts tried that, and they had to back off from it. Some places in Canada, because again, people don't like the idea that you're tracking how much money they're playing, how much money they're losing. But we're trying to help educate people and try to find some bonuses and rewards to do that. That will be still a couple years away before we're ready to do that. And we'll go out to try to get a system. And the Canadians are ahead of us on a lot of this, and so we're trying to learn from them and see what we can do. But that's what this will give us a chance to do.
Director Roberts, what's the market for a used lottery machine?
Terrible. It's most of them are sold overseas, and on a good day we can get $1,000 for a used machine. They cost about $14,000-$15,000 new. But there's a market. We're selling them.
Mm-hmm. Representative Whitson,
and I might have missed this. What is your payback percentage under both of the video lottery and then your regular lottery?
Pay back
to the person playing. I mean,
to the person playing. So what's our winning percentage? Well, it's interesting. Under the constitutional amendment that was passed, we have to pay back at least half in prizes. But the traditional, if we were just looking at that, we generally try to pay back about 70%. The video, we pay back about 94%. Although after they've played it several times, and you can see there's some places online where they show you how that happens. At the end of the day, we end up making about 72% of what they put into the machine and what they take out. But on each game, it's about a 94%. Now, the 94% is, you know, over time, we'll pay back 94% of the dollars. That doesn't mean that you win 94% of the time. So, like, if you play 10 times, you might lose 9 and then win $9 or something. 10 times you're playing $1. So, but on the payback on the video lottery for the players is ostensibly very good. But again, you got to multiply that by the number of times people play and how much goes into those machines. But that runs our numbers in terms of meeting the 50%. It's very easy. We do have to pay at least 50% back. And so some of the games that we have, the traditional games, you can get paid over years or take the cash. And the cash can be as low as 50%. And we adjust that from time to time based on what players do. It's amazing to me that we have some that pay 50% for cash, and otherwise you get it over 20 years. And in today's interest rates, that's a terrible deal to take cash, but about half the people do.
I just have a follow-up. So you've probably studied this. Is the attraction winning money, or is the attraction on these video lottery the game itself?
That's my point.
There is a lot of discussion about that now, and there are people who believe that the games themselves are addictive and attractive. I think there's not really a strong scientific basis to go that far, but clearly it is something that people enjoy doing, and there's frankly not enough money to justify them doing that, thinking they're going to get rich. In fact, we have people, since not all of us who work at the lottery are forbidden from playing. Which I find very interesting for a lot of people who would not think of playing otherwise, now have this great desire to play because they can't. But they all said, I wouldn't go do the video lot because you might win. I mean, at most for some of these, we've had the ability through some of our platinum spin and things, maybe you could get up to $10,000. Most of them are much less than that for a big jackpot on the video. Most people are winning $500 or $600. You win Powerball, and you retire. You're set for life. Of course, the odds against winning that or get that jackpot is 170 million to 1. But as people always say, someone wins. Okay, and so they still play that. But it's a different type of system. But I think the reason people play the draw games is because for a few days they can dream that all their problems have been solved. But I think on the games like the video, people do it because it's fun. That's why the having new games and refreshed games, that's important, because it's not enough just to go there. If it was just the payoff, we wouldn't have all the bells and whistles. You do it and roll the dice and win the money.
I just want to follow up. I've never played one. I've never seen a video lottery game. And so what I think of is playing traditional poker on a, like you can in Nevada. You know, you play a game and you draw a card to fit a hand or something, but could you explain what the games are for someone like me who's never seen one? I'm trying to envision if it's a game or is it a card game, or what is it exactly?
Yeah, it's interesting. The video poker is still basically cards, although the graphics have improved a lot. In the old days, it looked like a poker hand.
Right.
And you did that. And they've really beat those up a lot. But one of the things I didn't do on the chart here is show the breakdown between how much we make on the video poker versus the so-called line games, which we used to think of as slot machines, but they're so far beyond that in terms of the graphics and how they work. Now it's about 10% poker, and about 90% for the other. It's lost a lot of interest because it isn't really new, it isn't current. There's also been a rejuvenation in the last 10 years in live poker, particularly since they started putting poker game tournaments on TV and that people see it. And what it reminded people is that the fun thing about poker is not knowing which cards to discard and which to hold on to. I mean, you'll pick that up pretty fast. It's bluffing people, being able to read them, see what they're doing, and that's a social thing. And you're never going to get that playing with a computer. And so we're still going to keep, there are some diehard poker players, but most of it are these line games. And, of course, I have to confess now that I've never played any of these games. Even before I was in this position, it just wasn't something that I did. But I've looked at them, and I have to ask some of our staff, well, how do you know whether you won or not? Because they're very complicated. The thought is that that may be something that will, in fact, attract some of the younger people for the game value of it. And, you know, hopefully not become addicted, but at some point they might see that because they've really done a lot to screw set up. But it's... And they have all kinds of different combinations of things you can do. But those are a very different experience. The poker games are still basically, at the end of the day, regular poker. And they have a small, loyal following. But the real money and the real risk now of people, problem gamblers, are probably with the other games.
Thank you.
Listening to people talk to machines, one would think they were trying to bluff them. Please continue.
Well, I think I'm done. So,
okay.
If you have questions or anything more you want to know.
Colleagues, questions of Director Roberts? Mr. Bender, you've been waiting to pass out your chart.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I do have a chart that just basically indicates where lottery revenues are being used or going to this biennium. I just wanted to provide some numbers if you wouldn't mind taking one and passing these down to your colleagues. This is also, if anyone's listening on OLIS, it's the item that's labeled LFO 1315 Biennium Lottery Funds. And what this shows is basically where the lottery is generating or is projected to generate during this biennium approximately $2.16 billion in revenue. And most of that, almost the vast majority of that, is from wagering on the games. They also have some interest income and investment income that's added into that amount. This shows the disposition of those funds among various programs. And I've ranked them here in order of size. The items that are in red represent items that are costs of the agency of running the lottery and costs of creating the revenues, the $2.16 billion in revenues. These red barred items are items that the legislature really is not making direct decisions on. The decisions on these levels are made by the Lottery Commission and by the decisions of the agency as they implement the Lottery Commission's directions. The blue items are the items that are distributed, are amounts that are distributed by the legislature or have been distributed by the people through the form of constitutional amendments. So you can see that looking at these particular categories, the largest single distribution of the funds goes for retailer commissions. These are payments to retailers who are operating the games and citing the games in their locations and selling tickets. The next highest is the traditional game prizes. These are the prizes that are paid under the traditional game. As Director Roberts mentioned, for video lottery, they are the accounting, there isn't a separate expenditure noted for prizes. Instead, the revenues just include the net revenues after prizes are awarded in the games themselves. The largest of the items that the legislature is allocating is to the state school fund, approximately $327 million this biennium. The next largest would be for debt service on lottery bonds that have been approved by the legislature. That cost is approximately $240 million. The next two items in the list are constitutional dedications. The Education Stability Fund receives 18% of the money that's transferred from the Lottery Commission after expenses. That's projected to total about $189 million. And Measure 6676 allocates 15% of the net lottery revenues to parks and natural resources programs, split 50-50. Once those funds are provided, then the legislature, through the budgets of the receiving agencies, determines where those monies go. For the earlier bar, the Education Stability Fund, there are a number of the Constitution restricts those funds to public education from K through 12. In all instances, though, when the Education Stability Funds have been used, they have been transferred to the state school fund in times of economic downturn. So as was mentioned, this has been acting as a rainy day fund for the state school fund. Then there are other costs, again, continuing on, of the agency and operating the games. There are other expenses of $109 million, which would consist of services and supplies costs, things such as purchasing tickets, purchasing advertising, public information, and items of that nature. The agency, as was mentioned, has about 400 employees. Actually, I believe they're budgeted for about 468 to be employees, and compensation for the employees is the next highest item. Then the $72 million that goes to other state programs. Primarily, this component goes to the Oregon Business Development Department, which will be a budget that you will be working on later this session. Some of it, however, goes to the governor's office and to a few other programs. Then there is a distribution to counties. The money that's distributed to counties is dedicated by statute to economic development programs at the county levels. Then here's another category, game vendor charges. These include contracts that the lottery pays to the operators of the video system, as well as charges for traditional games as well. Then there's $10.6 million that you allocate to gambling addiction treatment programs. This money goes through the OHA budget. And there's $8 million that went through the Oregon University System budget, but I guess we'll be going through HEC now, for college scholarships, college athletics and scholarships at formerly the OUS institutions. And finally, there's $3.7 million for county fairs.
Mr. Director, I want to go back to the collegiate athletics and scholarships. Please correct me if any of my assumptions are wrong, but I think most of the athletic programs are awash in money, and the foundations that support our public universities for the purpose of assisting with program and student opportunity have lots of money. We are giving $8 million still to athletic. I don't know whether these are athletic scholarships or academic. I think they're academic. I'm trying to figure out why.
Well, the history of that, you may remember in 1988, we adopted, legislature, people who were here then, adopted the sports action game, which, it's my understanding, we could have just, the lottery could have just done. It did not need special authorization. But the authorization was necessary to dedicate that to colleges and universities for sports programs. At that time, Oregon and Oregon State were the only schools in what was then the Pac-10 that didn't receive any general fund money from the state. And so this idea came up, why don't we do that? We'll provide money. And they were not as, particularly those two schools, weren't nearly as healthy as they are today in their athletic departments. In addition to Oregon having strong benefactors, both those schools are now part of the Pac-12 network, where they get a ton of money from that. So I'm not going to argue that those schools need it. But the other schools, I think, the smaller ones, do struggle on some of the money, and that was the idea. But what happened was when they decided they didn't want to have sports lottery anymore and repealed the statute, although they said it didn't actually preclude having it, it just took away the authorization for that with the money going to the college university athletic departments. The decision then was made to replace that with just general lottery money because they're all educational institutions and would qualify. And that decision was made to the legislature. We have nothing to do with that. I'm not going to either defend or criticize it. It's just the decision that was made at the time to secure support for ending it. The reason they wanted to end the sports action lottery was at that time the NCAA said we will not have first round NCAA basketball games, men or women, in a state that allows for betting on sports, even though they didn't bet on amateur sports or college. And so because we were trying to get that to some of our venues here, they changed that. My understanding is that the NCAA has now kind of given up on that. They said, well, we're not going to have a Final Four tournament in a state that does that. And, of course, that's become such a huge extravaganza that the Moda Center would not even qualify for the finals. So the issue of whether we should revisit sports gambling is one that, frankly, I'd love to have that discussion someday. But there's no reason why the money has to be dedicated to that purpose. That's totally in your hands where that money goes. And I think you have to make the decision as to what's the highest and best use of it.
We're having this discussion at our peril in front of one of the biggest Ducks fans on the planet. And so I just want to make sure that...
Well, I might want to challenge that because did you go to the championship game?
Yep.
I didn't see you there, but no, it's there are a lot of people, but again, I think
we're wearing yellow.
The problems with the Ducks may have today are not money.
Yeah.
Senator Witz, I mean, Representative Witz.
I would like to address the $10 million in lottery bond proceeds that were allocated to the Department of Energy in. $5 million in 2013 and $5 million in 2014, which eventually ended up going to the Clean Energy Works of Oregon. And Clean Energy Works of Oregon does not report to the Department of Energy, so there's no performance-related reporting available there. And as a note, a search of the organization's website yielded no audit or performance reports for this $10 million. And so I looked up the front page of the Clean Energy Works, and it says, let's reset your happiness index. And so I'll just leave it there, but I'm not really sure what that's referring to, our happiness index and $10 million over the last 2 years that went there, and we don't have an audit of where the money went. And so I was wondering if we could get an audit of the Clean Energy Works and the $10 million that we bonded and will be paying for, I assume, for the next 20 years?
Well, you appropriated the money. I assume you can get an audit for it. We have no control over
okay.
that.
Okay. Whoever, I'd just like the committee to think about this for a minute. If we could ask for an audit of the $10 million that nobody has any auditor performance record on that was bonded with our lottery dollars.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions for the director? Senator Monroe.
Well, more of a response to you, Madam Co-Chair. My understanding is that $8 million is primarily for the small sports and women's sports that do not have piles and piles of money like men's football and men's basketball. And is actually a part of our adherence to Title IX.
I would just ask the professional staff to make a little note of that and see if we can run that to ground for the benefit of the committee. When you get the answer, if you distribute it to the whole committee, that'd be great. All right. Well, Mr. Director, unless you have any closing words.
No, thank you very much for your patience.
Madam Co-Chair, if I could just thank Ms. Ortega for joining us today.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Mr. Bender, any closing words on this matter?
No, just to let you know that tomorrow's meeting will be a informational meeting on ODOT minority contracting.
Thank you. Co-Chair Gomberg, any closing remarks?
Good to go. Thank you.
Anything for the good of the order? We're adjourned. Thank you. Good to the order? We're adjourned. Thank you.
Thank you.
Anything for the good